Welcome to Discount Gold and Silver Trading's Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen, your host for today's first segment. For the first 20 minutes today, I'll be bringing you my opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day. Melody will be joined by our good friend James Corbett in our second and third segments. Today is Friday, February 7, 2020. Thanks in advance to our producer and engineer, Todd. Let's get started with today's market report. Now, precious metals were somewhat topsy-turvy today. Gold took a little roller coaster ride. While spot gold was down slightly earlier today, it looks like it's up about $4, about a quarter of a percent at 1571 and change in the New York spot market. Silver down about 11 cents to $17.78. Palladium up about a half percent, $5 at $9.72. And wow, palladium on quite the roller coaster ride recently. That's down $14 today to $23.64 an ounce. Oil, too, is continuing its slide. Domestic West Texas crude, let's see, that was down, bear with me here. That's down about a little over a percent. $50.42 a barrel. International Brent down about three quarters of a percent at $54.53. The CBO VIX Volatility Index closed up. Last time I looked, it was closing in on 4% for the day at 3.8 at 15.53, and the fear and greed index now at 58, showing a little bit of greed. In contrast, let's see, about a third over last week's fear reading of 44, and a big decrease of 52% from last month's extreme greed reading of 92. Now, in the paper markets, virtually all global stocks were down today, except surprisingly the Shanghai Index, which was up over 0.3%, due in part to lingering tariff news from the other day, and despite the coronavirus's growing toll in that country. In the U.S. stock markets, investors seem to be taking profits ahead of continued bad news about the virus's economic impact, while again, surprisingly, minimizing the news concerning jobs and wages. The Dow Jones Industrial down about 0.9% to 29,102. The broader S&P 500 down a half a percent at 33.27. And the NASDAQ down 0.54% as well at 95.20 and change. Treasuries were also hit hard today. The bellwether 10-year down 0.06 to 1.585%. The 2-year down 0.04 at 1.405. And the long-term 30-year note down 0.07 rounds to at 2.047%. Now that comes, let's see, in concert with the U.S. dollar slight rise today of 0.2% to 98.69. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's DGS Coins Market Report, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. Melody is standing by. Ask her for any of our coin specials. Now, the government's headline unemployment rate ticked slightly higher today to 3.6% as the labor force participation rate increased 0.2% to 63.4%. That matches its highest level since June 13th, according to the Labor Department. Now, broader and more accurate labor market indicator that includes discouraged workers and those holding part-time positions for economic reasons, the so-called U6 unemployment rate also moved higher, rising 0.2% to 6.9%. We believe that really reflects closer to real rate. However, the employment to population ratio in the household survey rose to 61.2, its highest since November 2008, and a half percentage point higher than a year ago. And the year showed a decline in the total non-farm employment of 514,000. It's just a little higher than the 500,000 that economists had expected and that were indicated back in August. Now, the downward revision amounted to 0.3%, and that's higher than the usual plus or minus 0.2% change. The household survey also was weaker than the establishment survey used to tabulate the unemployment rate. Now, in terms of jobs, households actually reported a decline of 89,000, owing to a plunge in full-time workers of 656,000 and a jump in part-time workers of 537,000. While the total employment level in the survey dropped over the month, those counted as outside the labor force slid by almost 750,000, 729,000, and the total size of the labor force increased by 50,000 to 164.6 million. An unseasonably mild January helped power the U.S. jobs market to more gains in January, with non-farm payrolls rising 225,000 for the month, significantly above the 158,000 that the economists who were surveyed by Dow Jones were looking for. The weather-sensitive construction industry, not surprisingly, led the way in that job creation, adding 44,000 positions, well above its 2019 average of just 12,000. Manufacturing, meanwhile, which has been in a months-long slump, several economists believe it has been in recessionary mode for some time now, saw an additional loss of 12,000 positions, that owing almost completely to a drop in motor vehicles and parts. Now, let's see. Average hourly earnings rose 3.1% over a year ago to $28.44, ever so slightly ahead of estimates for 3% growth. That marked 18 consecutive months of wage gains above 3% as the initially unreported 2.9 for December was revised to an even 3. And the average work week was unchanged at 34.3. Julia Pollack, a labor economist at ZipRecruiter, said that weekly hours worked remains worryingly low. That's a problem because so many workers are struggling to find jobs that will schedule them to work enough hours so they can make ends meet. It could also be a sign that employers are concerned about the possibility that demand for goods and services might indeed weaken in the coming months. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, positive headlines often belie the details hidden within. We'll do our best to take the dive and report those details to you with truth and honesty. Now, back to the elephant in the room. Chinese authorities reportedly are resorting to increasingly extreme measures in Wuhan to try to spread the halt of the deadly coronavirus. We're reading that they've begun ordering house-to-house searches, rounding up the sick and warehousing them in enormous quarantine centers, some of which have just been built. The urgent, seemingly improvised steps come amid a worsening humanitarian crisis there. It's one that's been exacerbated by tactics that have left this city of 11 million with a death rate from the coronavirus of 4.1% as of yesterday, staggeringly higher than the rest of the country's rate of less than 0.2%. And with the sick now being herded into makeshift quarantine camps with minimal medical care, a growing sense of abandonment and fear has taken hold in Wuhan. Apparently, there just aren't nearly enough doctors and nurses to take care of the thousands in these camps. The harsh new moves in Wuhan, which is the epicenter of the outbreak, clearly signaled that the ruling Communist Party's alarm had failed to gain control of this growing epidemic. They evoked images of the emergency measures taken to combat the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic that killed tens of millions of people worldwide. And despite the severity of the new measures, however, they offered no guarantees of success. One observer, in fact, I believe she might be the vice premier, said that the city and country, meaning China, Wuhan and China, face wartime conditions. There must be no deserters or they will be nailed to the pillar of historical shame forever. Phew. Self-quarantines have been ordered for U.S. citizens who have been in other parts of mainland China. Foreigners who have been in China in the last 2 weeks, except for the immediate family of U.S. citizens and permanent residents and a few others, won't be allowed in at all. Crazy stuff. Quick note here about some gold statistics from the World Gold Council. Global-backed ETFs and similar products added 61 tons with net inflows of $3.1 billion in January across nearly all regions cross-world, boosting holdings to new all-time highs of 2,947 tons. Combined with a gold price increase of 4%, assets under management grew by 8% in U.S. dollars during the month. Now, quickly on a regional basis, holding in European funds increased by 33 tons, North American funds 29 tons, Asia were flat, they actually lost 1.2 tons, while the rest of the regions had marginal inflows of 0.7 tons. So that's that for gold inflows. Now, how about a little Friday trade talk? If the temporary transatlantic trade truce could come under pressure later this month if the U.S. follows through on a plan to increase its tariff paying on the European Union. As soon as a week or two from now, the U.S. could announce levies on a new tranche of European goods, champagne and leather handbags, stemming from a decades-old dispute over aircraft subsidies. We've reported about this in the past. Robert Lighthizer, who's the U.S. point man in the trade war, is threatening to deploy a particularly nasty trade tactic called carousel retaliation. That's where a country periodically shifts tariffs on different groups of goods, which spreads out the sanction pain across diverse industries, creating lots of uncertainty for businesses and headaches for exporters. If the U.S. follows through with its plan, it could hammer shares of European luxury brands like Givenchy and Hermes, which produce leather goods, and Remy Cointreau and Pernod Ricard, which make cognac and champagne. LVMH, Moët Hennessy, Louis Vuitton would be particularly vulnerable because it produces a wide variety of those kinds of products. Now, the genesis of this feud goes back 15 years when the U.S. and the EU started fighting along with WTO over these allegations of illegal subsidies to their respective airline industries. A couple of years ago, the Geneva-based trade arbiter said both the U.S. and the EU were guilty. Last fall, the WTO said the U.S. could legally impose tariffs on $7.5 billion worth of European exports in retaliation for Europe's aid to Airbus. In October, Washington imposed 10% duties on Airbus aircraft and 25% tariffs on a range of European consumer exports like Scotch, French wine, and Spanish olives. At the time, the U.S. held off on penalizing certain luxury goods like cognac and handbags, with administration officials saying their goal in imposing the tariffs was to persuade the EU to negotiate a settlement. But a transatlantic trade peace has proved elusive, and U.S. officials say the EU's overtures have just been unacceptable. A WTO ruling expected this summer could provide the EU with the right to retaliate against American goods in response to U.S. subsidies for the Boeing company. The EU's Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan is in Washington, has been in Washington this week, hoping to ward off these tariffs. But if he fails to persuade Lighthizer to halt the carousel tariffs, some of Europe's top luxury brands could definitely find themselves in America's crosshairs, which means higher prices paid by Americans. Quick aside, according to the UK, there's a pot of gold at the end of the Brexit rainbow marked trade deals. We will see. An agreement with the US appears to be a priority, but some economists say that the benefits of such a deal would offset only 1/7 of the cost of leaving the EU, which is the world's biggest single market. Looks like Boris and his bands of merry men and women have their work cut out for them over the coming months. Now, in the remaining time, which is very little in this segment, just a quick note, more than 2 years after Hurricane Maria hammered Puerto Rico, the Category 5 storm destroyed power poles, public buildings, homes, roads, and lots of other infrastructure from one end of the island to the other. An estimated $1.6 billion in insurance claims remain unresolved. The rest of that story will have to remain unresolved to another time. We are out of it, which means it's time for a short break. Melody will be here with James Corbett after these short messages. Thanks for listening to Financial Survival.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interest of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, and of course, I'm Melody Cederstrom, and this program is brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. And I am pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. I do enjoy our conversation. And as you may know, James is the founder and editor of The Corbett Report. It was founded in 2007. And in 2012, he became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster. And of course, we all remember that that was created by Robert Chapman. And you can visit James's website at thecorbettreport.com, and you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster just by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Well, hello, James.
Well, hello, Melody. How are you doing today?
Just fine, thank you. It's always great to have you here. And I guess we're going to get started right away. The last time, 2 weeks ago, our conversation included the coronavirus. It was just hitting the headlines, and there was discussions about it being weaponized. And as of this time this program is being recorded, some of the new headlines of the coronavirus consist of 73 new deaths on mainland from the virus outbreak. You have the U.S. can't keep the virus out of our borders. New York City has a couple of new patients under investigation. It's hitting cruise ships. I guess there's one around Japan. It's hitting car makers, airlines, Airbuses. It's going to hit the commodity market, the copper trade. It hits that. As China asked Chile to defer cargoes, you have the virus hits Hong Kong insurers. So we know that the Bank of China has began to inject billions of dollars into their markets, as we see billions of dollars being injected in all the markets around the world, as ours here in the States. So, what have you learned about the coronavirus since our last discussion, and how are you and your family adjusting to this threat and your perspective, and is it everyone taking it seriously, or is it life as usual?
Adjusting to the threat. Let me ask you a question, Melody. How many people do you know in your life who have died of coronavirus?
Let me count thy ways. That's one thing we were talking about today. We've had, millions and millions of people in this country with the flu.
Yeah.
Tens of thousands of people have died.
Yeah, exactly right. How many people have died of coronavirus that you know? I know zero. I'll put that out there. Mm-hmm. How many people do you know have the coronavirus?
So what's going on?
Look, I don't know. Short answer, I don't know. And is it good to take precautions and wash your hands and have a healthy immune system and take your vitamin C and everything? Absolutely, at all times. Not just for coronavirus, but for flu and sickness of all sorts. Certainly, take proper precautions and be good to your body. But should, I don't know, just personally, am I freaking out about this coronavirus? Absolutely not. Do I see any signs of that here in my day-to-day life in Japan? No, I do not. I don't see any major changes to daily life here in Japan. And I don't think there is cause for such major changes at this particular point. Now, there are those in the audience who may be protesting that the Chinese are covering this up and there are tens of thousands more cases or hundreds of thousands more cases and everybody's dying and it's horrible. Well, that may be the truth, but I don't know. And I'm not going to change my life because of it. Again, take proper precautions and be good to your body, but do so at all times and don't freak out specifically over this. I say this specifically because it certainly is a possibility, and it has been floated by a number of people, and there are definitely data points to back it up, that this could be some type of biowarfare weapon. Although, as has been pointed out, if this is a bioweapon that has been released strategically on purpose for some reason, or perhaps by accident. It is an exceptionally ineffective bioweapon. It has, at this point, from what we know, and again, it could be a big cover-up, but so could everything else in the world, from what we know, it's got about a 2% mortality rate, which makes it an extraordinarily ineffective bioweapon. Again, it certainly could be a bioweapon, and there are a lot of concerns, legitimate concerns, I think, about the Wuhan Institute that includes a biosafety laboratory level 4, which is basically handling bioweapon level materials and samples, and it certainly seems more plausible than the people were eating bat soup explanation that we've gotten so far, which is no explanation at all. It would also account for some anomalies that have been pointed out. For example, Thai doctors are saying that they are having amazing success treating the coronavirus in Thailand with a mixture of HIV antiretroviral drugs and other flu medications. But then again, that may be because there is a exceptionally high HIV rate in Thailand, so perhaps that might just be actually reflecting the state of the health of the population generally. Again, there's a lot of things that we don't know about this at this point, so I'll let you know once I've got it all figured out. I don't think anyone does at this moment, but again, I'm not freaking out about this at this point. The real question would be, okay, let's assume it is a bioweapon that has been released. If so, was it released on purpose, or was it released as an accident? Certainly, if it's coming from internally within China, I would put my money on it being released as an accident. I don't know why China would be doing this to itself, especially because, as you intimated, the economic repercussions of this will be huge and detrimental, obviously, to the Chinese economy, because, as we've already seen, it's already affecting distribution and supply lines. It is affecting the Chinese economy already, stocks hitting limit downs and etc. So obviously this is not something that the Chinese government would want to implement. That does raise the specter, well, if it comes from outside, like, say, the United States, where, for example, the anthrax that killed people in the wake of 9/11, we know came from Fort Detrick and was handled by people there, although the official explanation for that has been largely forgotten at this point, but we know it came from U.S. Military stock and grade. So we know that the U.S. does handle bioweapons. Well, if they release this in China for some reason, why would they do that? Well, perhaps because it is part of the demonization of the Chinese government in the eyes of the world, which it certainly has done. I know from following Canadian media that Canada is freaking out about China and its inability to handle this crisis. An even more intriguing part of the sort of larger meta conversation that we could be having about this, it relates to a type of simulation or prediction that was done in 2010 via the auspices of our good old friends at the Rockefeller Institute, who funded a study that was looking at the beneficial ways that basically medical martial law could be used to crack down in the event of something like exactly what we're seeing right now, the spread. I believe they were talking about a flu that had derived from geese at that point, but essentially the same as this coronavirus epidemic, as we're being told. They're basically the embedded within that report that they issued as a result of their study was, wouldn't it, it's so great, we need these medical martial law things to be able to crack down and stop people from going outside, etc. And that is something that is being pointed out, at least to a certain extent, in the media that's covering this coronavirus scare right now, is that look at China, they have this dictatorship, so they can crack down and they can stop people from going places and they can really lock down entire cities of millions of people. You just couldn't do that in the US of A or elsewhere in the free liberal Western democracies, so-called, of the Western world. We can't do that. Wouldn't it be great if we had these kinds of powers? Which, of course, is something that has been being worked on behind the scenes for years and years now. You might remember SARS and Zika virus and Ebola and bird flu. I'm sure I'm missing a couple of other scares out there, but in the wake of every single one of those declared pandemics, Every single time they forward legislation for medical martial law and basically taking people's rights away in the event that this is called some sort of quarantine situation and they're going to have to lock down the city. We've even seen Hollywood films that are secretly funded by billionaires like Pierre Omidyar that have in the past talked about bioweapons being released and how we would have to shut down the city in the event of this. So there's a lot going on here that we need to delve into, but I would say generally speaking, personally, I am not worried. I'm not freaking out. I'm not changing my life. I'm not hunkering down and refusing to go outside because of this. Although I am certainly interested in the whatever information will be forthcoming that will prove or disprove the bioweapon hypothesis.
Well, also, my question, and you mentioned it, the economic impact. How is that going to spread to the rest of the world? Or will it? I mean, with SARS, I believe their GDP, if I remember correctly, dropped 2%.
Right, yeah.
Dropping 2% now is a whole lot different.
So we certainly could see similar effects as a result of this. I think it remains to be seen given how quickly this pandemic spreads or stops spreading will determine the extent of the effect that this has. But we've already, as I say, have seen some of the effects of this in the Chinese stock market. So we know that things are happening, although the Chinese stock market is as phony as a $3 bill, but at any rate, it gives people some sort of sense of which way things are trending. And, of course, the Chinese government will and can pump liquidity into the Chinese markets to prop them up, but they can only get away with that for so long. So we'll see the effects of that, and where else this goes in the world, essentially, will be part of the question as to how this affects people economically. Now, I would say that one of the economic effects of this that should not be overlooked is, in fact, something that happened during the bird flu pandemic of 2009 that I noted at the time and that was a story that did not get the coverage it deserved. But one of the effects of the World Health Organization declaring a global public health emergency or the pandemic emergency or whatever particular label they give it, there's a certain term that they use, that comes with it certain embedded clauses and agreements that are part of treaties that basically every nation on the planet has signed up to, which mandates governments around the world to buy emergency prepared vaccines from vaccine manufacturers. And it came out in the wake of that 2009 declaration of the WHO bird flu pandemic that the people on the WHO committee that were deciding whether or not this was a pandemic that needed emergency vaccines and all this, which you will remember, actually, the bird flu turned out to have even a lower mortality than the regular flu that particular year. So it was a complete scam. But the scam on top of the scam was those people sitting on that committee were the very same executives from the big pharma manufacturers who were manufacturing the vaccines who got billions of dollars in automatic contracts with the declaration of that emergency. Even the Council of Europe came out and said this was a scam and look at what happened. And well, guess how many people went to jail for that? Precisely no one. But there are billions of dollars on the line every single time the World Health Organization sticks its nose in and starts declaring emergency pandemics. And that's something, that's a part of the story we should at least have in mind and be following.
You know, the other day on the program, Dave and I started to talk about the world spending about $3 trillion on weapons, with the U.S. driving about four-fifths of the globe's armed trades. This report was put out by the U.S. State Department, and the global arm transfers rose 65% from 2007 to 2017. I don't know how much of that shows up in our GDP, but that's a lot of money. And I can't imagine this is good foreign policy, but is it? And you know, is it good foreign policy for the U.S., for the EU? And are we just, you know, are we being set up to reap what we sow?
I'm sorry, you're going to have to repeat that. What specifically good foreign policy?
This weapon trade, $3 trillion on weapons, the world is spending.
Right.
This report was put out by the U.S. State Department. And the United States accounted for 79% of the global arms trade. $143 billion annually. Is this good foreign policy for the U.S.?
Well, that's a nice softball question for me. Thank you. Yes, no, I think it is not a good foreign policy. But I haven't seen that latest report with those latest figures. I have talked about this issue in the past before, though. Looking, for example, at a video that I did a few years ago called The Real Cost of the War of Terror, which was adding up the numbers that were are thrown around with regards to weapon sales and contracts and things along those lines with regards to the never-ending ongoing war of terror that the U.S. empire has been in for the last two decades now. Everything from the ridiculous, you know, look at this, the Pentagon's paying $640 for a toilet seat kind of thing, which obviously gets people outraged but doesn't quite get to the heart of the issue, to the $1 trillion in police state, homeland security, Pentagon, intelligence agency budget, all the way up to the $1.5 trillion of spending on the F-35, the $6.5 trillion of year-end adjustments that the Pentagon's making on an annual basis to make their books balance by some sort of accounting wizardry. And basically, the end of that video, spoiler alert for people who haven't seen it, it's only 5 minutes long, but it says that ultimately the real cost of this is not, oh, you know, it should not be outrage about the dollar amount that the Pentagon is wasting. It should be outrage that this is ultimately fueling deadly, bloody wars around the world that are killing men, women, and children, including, of course, innocent men, women, and children at weddings and other places. We see those that type of story in the news on an all-too-regular basis and just kind of dismiss it. Oh, another 13 people got bombed at some, you know, Afghan wedding today. Oh, well, they must have had it coming. That's, of course, the thing that gets excluded from this. But, yeah, does this lead to good foreign policy to be essentially a weapons salesman and procurer around the world? Of course not. And, of course, that only fuels the violence. And if there is a market for violence, then the market is going to find ways to provide need for violence. And this is not conspiracy theory. This is complete, just basic economics. And we can see the way this has played out with Lockheed Martin and other defense industry contractors literally sitting on important Pentagon panels that envision, you know, war fighting of the future, and not only spend, as I say, trillions of dollars developing flying jalopies like the F-35, but even more sadly do direct foreign policy to embroil America and its allies into war after war after war to justify using up the stock and buying more.
So this was just another area that they could move into to me it looks like this is something they have to do just to keep the system going. I mean, $3 trillion versus, you know, everything else. But, I mean, that's how desperately I believe this country needs those funds.
It's a charade, but it is one that at least provides something for the people who are working in these factories and these businesses, so people go along with it. And once you base the entire system on a charade, how do you get rid of the charade without bringing it all down crashing?
We're heading to a break, ladies and gentlemen. It's the music giving us the warning. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival.
Just one more time. Oh, won't you tell me again? Tell me again tonight. Each and every heart is
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today. Complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival. I'm Melody Suderstrom, and I'm here with my guest, James Corbett. And James, during the break, we were talking about you will be heading, well, I can't say south, I guess south to the U.S., but you're heading into Mexico, Acapulco, for a convention, and you will be speaking.
That's right.
I don't know if it's a convention, but could you share it with the listeners, please?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I guess I'll be heading south of Japan and very far east as well. But then again, Japan's in the east, so I guess it's west, but I'll be flying east. Anyway, yes, Mexico, specifically Acapulco, Mexico. I will be there next week for a conference called Anarchapulco. That is Anarchapulco. Anarchapulco.com is where you can go to find out more details about the conference. It is a collection of those dastardly scary anarchists who will be meeting for a few days to basically listen to talks by people like myself and Larkin Rose and others that will be familiar to the anarcho community. But also, Dr. Ron Paul will be there. Judge Andrew Napolitano, I believe, will also be there. Some big names are going to be there, and hopefully I'll get to meet some of them and maybe even get to interview a few of them if all things go well. So that will be fun. And I will be giving a talk specifically on the most dangerous superstition, as Larkin Rose has termed it, the belief in governmental authority. So I hope people will be able to check it out. But if not, I believe if you go to anarchapulco.com, they do have a package that you can purchase for video live streaming the entire event, and you can see all the different presentations as they're being made and all of that. Details are there at the website, so people can check that out.
Very nice, and we'll look forward to rejoining us when you return and maybe sharing us with some little insights from the meeting, from the conference. In a recent article you wrote, the newsletter has a number of phrases and names I have to admit I haven't heard before. And Betteridge's Law of Headlines, Wolfgang Pauli, and Kit Knightley, just to name a few. You use those phrases and names in addressing the central topic of your article. Has Vladimir Putin just set the framework of becoming Russia's leader for life? And what's happening in Russia?
Excellent question. Yes, for people who don't know Betteridge's Law of Headlines, mm-hmm. you may have heard it before. Basically, it's the old maxim that if a newspaper headline or an article starts with, or is a question, as in, did Russia just undergo regime change? Then you can safely answer that question with the word no. No, it did not. And that's a pretty good rule of thumb to apply. It's not always true, but it's often true. If you see a question mark in the headline, it's generally because they can't actually go out and say that something is happening. They just kind of want to imply it, and, oh, we didn't say anything. Anyway, it is kind of journalistic weasel way of getting out of actually saying something when you can't really justify it. And that's why I called this particular newsletter, Did Russia Just Undergo Regime Change? The answer, I think, is pretty much a no. But there are some interesting caveats for that. So for people who didn't see, Vladimir Putin, every year he gives an address to the Russian parliament. I can't remember off the top of my head what they call it, but he gives this address every year to the Russian Federal Assembly. That's it. And generally this takes place in late February, early March, somewhere around then. But this year was very different. It took place right after the new year, early January, and usually he talks for a good deal about domestic Russian politics and economy and what the Russian government is going to do to help the Russian people, and then goes into some sort of thing about the international order and, you know, how Russia and Chinese partnership will save the world and that kind of stuff. This year, after talking about demographics, Russian demographics, and the demographic crunch that is that Russia is facing with the birth rate falling down, I can't remember what it is right now, but somewhere 1.5 or maybe even less than that at this point, well below replacement rates, meaning that the Russian population will start shrinking in the near future, like most of the rest of the world as well. And he did address that for some at some length in this speech and talk about what the Russian government is going to do to encourage more families, et cetera, et cetera. And then he pivoted in a way that I don't think anyone was expecting to talk about a massive overhaul of the Russian government, the constitution, and the presidency. And essentially, for people who missed it, there was weeks of Russia watchers basically talking back and forth about what this meant, what was he proposing, what's on the table, why did this happen, and then you might have seen that the entire Russian cabinet basically resigned right after this speech, and for people who didn't see the follow-up, about a week later, the new cabinet was appointed, and it contained a lot of the major names from the old cabinet, just in kind of a shuffle. So what on earth is going on here? The short answer that I do not provide in this article is, I don't know. Essentially, no one really knows exactly what's happening for a number of different reasons, one of which is I don't speak Russian, and so I'm just working from English translation, as a lot of the other English commentators on this are. And that, of course, brings you into trouble when you're reading an English translation of an address in a foreign language like Russian that has nuances and interpretations that we can't possibly know from the translation itself, including even some of the most pivotal and important parts of this statement, where, for example, Putin was addressing the idea of term limits on the Russian presidency. People might know that in the Russian Constitution, as it was formulated in 93, I want to say, was when the Russian Constitution was passed. Anyway, of course, in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the craziness that was going on at that time, that was when the Russian Constitution, as it exists today, was formulated and passed. And in that, it had a proviso that the Russian president cannot hold the office for more than two consecutive terms, which is why Putin held it for two terms from 99 or 2000 or whenever he formally stepped into office. He held it for two terms, and then he went to the prime ministership for a term, and then he came back and has been Russian president for one term now. He's into his second term. So he will be facing that second term consecutive limit in 2024, at which point I believe he's going to be pushing 70 years old, maybe 70 by that point. So presumably I'm looking to head out the door and say goodbye to politics. What does this mean? Or will he hang on? Will he try to be dictator for life? Well, he did address this in the address, and he did talk about this idea of term limits, but even the way that part of the speech was interpreted or translated, or what it says in the translation, puts an ambiguity on it, whether or not he was saying he wants the term limit to end, or whether he thinks the second term, the two-term limit, is a good thing. I mean, even that can be read both ways. So literally every part of the speech was head-scratching. And then on top of that, the actual legislative proposals that have been forwarded since the speech seem to contradict the speech or what he was saying in the speech in certain ways. So, as I say, as I point to in the article, there's a lot of different people with a lot of different takes on this, and the consensus that has formulated so far is no one knows exactly what's happening, but there are, of course, people speculating that Putin will try to stay on after 2024 in the presidency role. There are other people saying, no, you see, he's putting shackles on the president and what the president is able to do, like appointing the cabinet and other things that he's talking explicitly about taking out of the hands of the president and putting in the hands of the Federal Assembly, and the prime minister having more powers. So does that mean he's going to move back to the prime minister, basically hobble the presidency so it's not as important when he's out of office? Or is he trying to create some special council, some sort of national security council type of thing that already exists, but it isn't formally a part of the Russian government, but he's talking about making it a formal part of the Russian government, so maybe he'll step into that and sort of preside over the next president. Or maybe he's doing this as a way to stop the, you know, the evil Western influence from infiltrating and basically taking over the presidency with whoever his successor is. I mean, again, there's a million different possibilities. The one that I think is most likely, I think my feeling is that Putin is not going to try to stay on as president after 2024, and I think the take that makes most sense to me is the one by Gilbert Doctorow. He was published at antiwar.com with a few articles on the subject in the past few weeks, and his take essentially is that basically Putin is trying to control and contain the presidency role and basically rein it in a little bit so that it's not as powerful as it has been in the past. And why specifically is doing this is open to interpretation. There are people who assert this is because Putin is a once-in-a-lifetime political phenomenon who's been able to use that power, but he knows that no one will be able to fill his shoes. There are other people saying this is a preemptive counter-coup attempt, and, you know, again, lots of different interpretations. But essentially, I think this, he's just basically putting some shackles on the presidency role and making it so it's not as game-changing and important a role as it has been for the past couple of decades. So in the end, I mean, perhaps this isn't even a groundbreaking, earth-shaking type of thing. Maybe it's just sort of the growing pains of a relatively young democracy when you think about it. But it certainly took a lot of people by surprise when it happened.
Is there anyone, if he leaves his position in 2024, is there someone, or is there anyone right now that would likely take his place, or at least
is
be in the running?
Anyone specifically? Mm-hmm. I don't believe so. I don't. Who knows, right? I mean, mm-hmm. from so many different perspectives. But the person who was just installed as prime minister is kind of a who's that kind of person. Even Russia watchers are not very familiar with him, and he seems to be more of a technocrat from Moscow who hasn't had a particularly notable career yet. So it seems perhaps, I mean, if he is grooming someone or trying to put someone in a position that will be able to take a presidency, maybe he wants a sort of dull, bland person, a non-person to basically make sure there is no cult of personality over the presidency. Perhaps that's a strategy. But, I mean, I'm sure dedicated Russia watchers would have a more insightful answer to that. But just in terms of what I've read and seen, I haven't seen anyone who's really explosive and is some sort of personality who's likely to dominate in the way Putin has. All of the potential successors seem, at the very least, to be, if not obscure, forces within Russia, at least certainly internationally, sort of non-players at this point.
Your most recent article on the CorbettReport.com is called "The CIA, the New York Times, and the Art of the Limited Hangout." What do you mean by the limited hangout, and what can you tell, and what that can tell you about the CIA and the New York Times article you mentioned about the mighty Wurlitzer?
That's right. So this goes back to a video that I released a couple of weeks ago on my Propaganda Watch series, where I look at different pieces of propaganda and sort of dissect how it works. And in that video, I noted that in my research recently, I came across this little gem from the New York Times from late 1977, Worldwide Propaganda Network Built by the CIA. And it's a pretty extensive article, so if people bring up my article, I suggest they go and actually read through, or at least skim through, that New York Times article, because it is thousands of words long, and they do go into some detail about what they identify as this extremely expansive global propaganda network that the CIA literally owned and controlled. And they're talking mostly in the past tense about this is what the CIA was doing in the 50s and 60s, but it's not doing that now in 1977, guys. So you get the idea of, you know, don't worry, this is what used to happen. But they do talk about the 800-plus media entities, radio stations, publishing houses, academic publishers, newspapers, magazines that the CIA either directly outright owned through their front companies, of course, or had editorial control over because they had agents in positions of editorial control. And they document that. But this is where the limited hangout comes out. And for people who don't know, that's an intelligence term that means essentially to give some information and some real verifiable true information that may even be new and shocking to the public. Oh, look at this. You know, the New York Times has just come out with this big expose about the worldwide propaganda network built by the CIA. But it's the part of the limited hangout is to give some real and true and interesting information in order to hide or obscure or direct attention away from other more important information. And in this case, the details that I go on to fill in the article relate to the timing of this New York Times article, because if you just see this New York Times article that came out in December of 1977 in a contextless way, you'd think, wow, the New York Times really, you know, they were really blowing the whistle on this and they were doing some great work here, really digging in. But why? Why specifically? Why did they suddenly come out with this? Especially because it's pretty clear if you read the report that clearly, I mean, New York Times and others knew about this before this point. It wasn't they just discovered it in 1977. They're just deciding to report on it in 1977. Why then? You have to place it into its historical context, coming after the Church Committee hearings of 1975 that opened the door on a lot of intelligence agency shenanigans, including MK Ultra and mind control and heart attack guns and assassination programs and all sorts of things that were revealed during that. But also the U.S. intelligence agency's relationship with the U.S. media. And in the wake of that and the type of reporting that was going on around that, you had things like Carl Bernstein's seminal essay that was published in Rolling Stone in October of 1977 called The CIA and the Media. And if you haven't heard of that, you should go check it out, because, again, this is a big expose of the CIA's relationship with the U.S. and international media as it existed at that time in October of 1977. So, and in that article, Bernstein documents not just the New York Times, but Time Inc. and CBS and NBC and basically, I mean, Newsweek, Saturday Evening Post, Hearst Newspapers, Reuters, every major media organization you can think of, either, again, directly working with the CIA, had on contract agents, CIA agents working in there, including the New York Times had, as Bernstein reports, at least 10 CIA agents directly on staff at the New York Times during the period he was documenting in the 60s. So, a lot of information. Guess what the New York Times left out of their report? Any of that. It was all about the international propaganda. It wasn't about U.S. No, there were no U.S. organizations involved. So it was a cover-up, essentially.
Hey, we're out of time. That music's been playing. Thank you so much, James, for joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, get to the website, thecorporatereport.com. We'll be back on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, be safe, good night, and God bless.
Digital audio, 22,500 miles above the planet. This is the Global Star Radio Network.